Welcome to this segment of A Day at DPL, a thought leadership series that is part of the Advisor Revelations podcast. You will hear from DPL's founder and CEO, David Lau, and a special guest where they will discuss educational topics around industry trends and best practices, providing advisors insights to grow your business and better serve clients.
It's David Lau. I'm here today with Micah Hoffman on our Advisor Revelations podcast here at DPL. We're going to be talking about something very timely today, the new DOL rule focused on retirement security. And Micah is the Director of Investor Protection at the Consumer Federation of America. This is a topic near and dear to his heart. He's been a very outspoken proponent of the rule, as have I. And Micah's got a long history of consumer protection on the financial services industry. And I think this was one of the topics that really got you interested in the space. So Micah, if you want to just give everyone, a little bit of background on how you got to where you are and why, this has been such a compelling topic for you.
Well, first, thanks for having me, David. It's great to be here. And it's been great to get to know you through our work on the CFP Board Standards Resource Commission. So yeah, this is an issue that is near and dear to my heart. I began my career in consumer advocacy in 2011 at another consumer advocacy organization, Public Citizen, where I worked on a broad range of financial and tax policy issues. And in 2013, the House of Representatives took up a bill that was deceptively named the Retail Investor Protection Act, despite the fact that it in no way protected retail investors. It would have protected financial professionals who seek to profit at vulnerable investors' expense. So the bill was a response to the first time that the Department of Labor tried to modernize standards of conduct for financial professionals who provide retirement investment advice. And the DOL in 2010 proposed a rule that drew widespread opposition, including from consumer advocates. The DOL rightly realized that it got a number of things wrong, and it withdrew that first proposal. It agreed to go back to the drawing board to get things right. But that 2013 bill was designed to put up roadblocks, designed to delay and possibly derail the DOL from acting in this space. So when the bill was taken up, that was my first exposure to investor protection issues. And the more I learned, the more I became interested and saw a need for investors to have their advocate in Washington, D.C. There were very few consumer advocates working in this space, and there were seemingly unlimited number of financial industry lobbyists who were advocating for their own interests. And so I stepped into this space, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to be involved. And shortly after that bill was luckily defeated, there was an opening at the Consumer Federation of America, and that position focused on investor protection issues, and I jumped at the opportunity. So I worked there for 7 years, focusing on the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers and insurance professionals. And then in 2020, my friend Caroline Crenshaw became an SEC, Securities and Exchange Commissioner. I went to work for her for several years, and then I returned to CFA to lead on investor protection issues, and here I am.
That's fantastic. I think that's why we're kindred spirits, kind of approaching, consumer advocacy and protection from different angles. But, I consider myself the same. I'm, first and foremost, a consumer advocate and try to, impact, consumer benefit really from the product manufacturing side for my career, from banking to brokerage, now in insurance. And it resonated with me when we were building, kind of the first internet bank in the country. It was about taking cost out of the product really for the consumer to provide them with better products. And that just really resonated with me. And it's driven my career. And in banking, like the fact that building branches is expensive, or, you know, particularly back in those days, right? Building branches was really your only access to banking products and services. That wasn't like an insidious thing, right? I mean, it just was a fact. You know, you built branches, that's the way business was done. It just happened to be expensive, and it happened to be better for the consumer to deliver those products and services in a better way. In insurance, it's been much different, where to me, it's really the commission that has been the thing that I particularly find a little bit offensive, in that it drives up so much of the cost of the product for the consumer. It's not just a way of delivering product. It's a way that incentivizes all kinds of bad behaviors, bad pricing, bad products, all kinds of things that really need to be corrected. And as I pointed out to you, I've really enjoyed some of your comments on the topic as this DOL rule has come out, and, you know, both of us have been featured a lot in different stories. But give me your thoughts relative to the, you know, to the current DOL rule. I think one of the interesting things you pointed out is it's really not like kind of a new rule. It's really trying to close a loophole. And, you know, maybe you want to talk about that.
Yeah. So I agree with a lot of what you just said. There are inherent costs to building products, including insurance products, but there are a lot of excessive costs that can be baked into products. And the more those costs are loaded into the products, the more those costs are passed on to consumers. And in many cases, it is the compensation that increases the cost for consumers. And the higher the commission, the more costs that consumers pay. And that can really undermine consumers' retirement savers, retirement security, if they have to pay excessive costs that ultimately drain their retirement. I will also add that I'm not anti-commission. I think that commissions do have a place in investment advice, that consumers should be able to pay for products and services in a number of ways, but they should never give up their right to receive advice that's in their best interest. And unfortunately, the rules that have applied to the provision of investment advice have not required financial professionals to act in their client's best interest in all cases. There have been loopholes that have allowed financial professionals to put their own interests ahead of their customers, and that can be really detrimental to investors. And this space is really complicated because there are a number of different government regulators who are involved in this space. So there's the Department of Labor, which regulates retirement accounts and retirement investment advice. So regardless of what type of financial professional you are, if you're serving a retirement account, the DOL has authority over you. And then there's the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, which regulates securities professionals, broker-dealers, and investment advisors. And then there are state insurance regulators, which regulate state-regulated insurance professionals and insurance products. And it's best to think of this as a Venn diagram, where there's some overlap, and then there are some areas where different regulators have exclusive jurisdiction. So happy to talk about any of those, but the DOL is the most recent rule, so that's probably the most relevant for today.
Yeah. So if you're, you know, when you're thinking about the DOL rule and what it's trying to address, you know, really retirement investment advice was designed since ERISA back in the 70s to be fiduciary advice, right? But that really, in a way that it was written, kind of only wound up applying to AUM advisors. But if so, you could kind of have a loophole if you were compensated by commission. And this is really designed to kind of close that loophole. Is that a fair way of characterizing it, you think?
Yeah, that's exactly right. ERISA was became law in 1974, and it really stood for the simple proposition that if you provide retirement investment advice for a fee, you are a fiduciary. And what that means is you have a duty of care to act as a prudent professional, and you have a duty of loyalty to act in your client's best interest, so you can't take advantage of them. And you have to charge reasonable compensation for your services, so you can't charge excessive amounts. And I think that that is a really sensible approach that most reasonable people would support, unless your financial interests are at odds with that. And as you mentioned, there are several loopholes in ERISA. So ERISA became law in 1974, but then the following year in 1975, the DOL promulgated rules that defined what constitutes fiduciary investment advice. And those rules significantly narrowed that definition, creating loopholes that allow financial professionals to effectively evade their fiduciary duty. So in other words, that they could act in their own interest at their client's expense. So for example, while the statute says nothing about how often financial advice, investment advice has to be provided, the 1975 definition said that advice has to be provided on a regular basis, which means if you provide one-time advice, for example, if you recommend a rollover, or if you recommend a transaction, an annuity transaction, and charge by commission, that wouldn't be covered. So there was another loophole that said, while ERISA says nothing about the extent to which a retirement investor must rely on the advice for it to be fiduciary advice, the 1975 definition said that there needs to be a mutual agreement between the investment advice provider and the investment advice recipient that the advice would form a primary basis for their investment decision. And so many firms would include fine print legal disclaimers in their contracts saying, you should not rely on the recommendations that we provide as a primary basis for your investment decision. And despite the fact that that's the whole point of the recommendation.
Right. And I think, as you know, many have pointed out, including me, including you, I think consumers would be surprised to learn today that the investment advice, the retirement investment advice they have, doesn't necessarily need to be in their best interest. I think they would be surprised to learn that. It would be like learning there are some doctors you go to who aren't necessarily having to cure, you know, give you the best medical advice. You know, like, it's a very important topic, right? So this isn't like selling you a car or something like that. This is a very important topic, critical to your financial future in a very vulnerable financial time being retirement. And to learn that somebody doesn't have to have your best interest in mind, I think would be quite stunning to most people.
Yeah, I totally agree. It effectively allows financial professionals to function as investment advisors, but without requiring them to act in their client's best interest. It allows them to take advantage of retirement investors who are vulnerable, who need advice in their best interest to thrive in retirement. And if we look at how the market works, in 1974 and 1975, when ERISA became law and the rules were promulgated defining fiduciary investment advice, it was a really different market. Most people had pensions, and pensions were run by very sophisticated investors who knew how to invest. But now people are on their own. We've moved to 401ks and IRAs, and there's an increase in rollovers, and financial products and services have become increasingly complex. And so what we've done is push more responsibility onto individuals for making their own retirement investment decisions at a time when those decisions have increasingly become difficult to make. And so it should come as no surprise that more and more individuals are turning to financial professionals for advice. They're placing their trust in financial professionals. They defer to them and their expertise, and they reasonably expect and rely on the advice that they receive to be in their best interests. And at the same time, financial professionals hold out as trusted advisors. They use titles like financial advisor, which give the impression of specialized expertise. And in insurance markets in particular, many insurance professionals characterize themselves as, quote, trusted advisor. There was an insurance group advertising campaign a couple of years ago, and the tagline was, trust your future with a NAIFA advisor. And there was a video advertisement on their website that said, contact us for advice you can trust. We adhere to a code of ethics that's all about honesty and integrity, and we're committed to working with you and guiding you with a financial plan that will lead you to a secure retirement. So any reasonable consumer who sees that advertisement is going to reasonably believe that they're getting high quality investment advice that they should trust and rely on.
I'll make the connection back to what you said about not being opposed to your commissions. And I may be a little more opposed than most, but I'm open-minded. Like, I'm open-minded to hearing reasonable cases for it. But what I think should be clear, and this is, you know, I think the point you're getting to, is that if you are going to operate under that model, it should be very clear to the consumer that that's the model you're operating under. And the insurance industry has in many ways, you know, tries to obfuscate that, you know, whether it's through the advertising or the titling of the financial professional. They're not a broker, they're not called a salesperson, a broker. They get approved to be called advisors. And it's interesting, you know, I think as you pointed out, this lawsuit that has already been filed, you know, against the new DOL rule, it kind of goes against all that public, you know, all that public disclosure. So you maybe talk about that and, you know, how the focus of that is, hey, we're just salespeople. Don't try to make us fiduciaries.
Yeah, you're exactly right that they advertise like investment advisors, and no reasonable consumer would view them as anything other than an investment advisor. No reasonable investor would view these relationships as arm's length sales relationships like a one that a consumer has with a car dealer. And yet, that's how these financial professionals characterize their services when they go into court and try to evade their fiduciary duty. So you mentioned a lawsuit. There's one insurance lobby group that they call themselves the Federation of Americans for Consumer Choice. And even their name is hypocritical because while they say that they represent consumers, in their legal filings, they say their members are IMOs, independent marketing organizations, insurance agents, and agencies that market fixed insurance products. And they say that their primary purpose is to ensure the even-handed regulation so that consumers can continue to benefit from annuity products. But then the group turns around and claims that its members are not in relationships of trust and confidence with its consumers, that its members are nothing more than sales agents merely making sales calls. That's the distinction that really bugs me.
Yes, exactly. So, hey, peace, if you want to have that business model, and you know, that's fine, but let's not try to say on one hand, that you're not operating like that, in that you're not just a salesperson, that you are an advisor, you know, looking to give your clients trusted advice. And on the other hand, say, oh, well, if you're actually going to hold us to that, no, we're not. We're salespeople. That should be clear. So which way is it? And that's ultimately to protect consumers. I think that is the distinction. You want to operate under that model? That's fine. But you know, people should understand if they're speaking to you, they're speaking to a salesperson, not an advisor. There's no going furthering the car salesman analogy. You go to a car dealership, you know you're working with a salesperson. You know, there is no question about that, right? You didn't bring somebody along, your mechanic, maybe you did, I don't know, to give you financial, you know, the advice on the car, but you're dealing with somebody there, you know you're dealing with a salesperson. If you walk into a financial professional's office, you may not know the distinction. And that's, I think, the essence of the point. You should have clarity on that. So for us, you know, you're familiar with the business. What we're trying to do is help, and I know you've got some thoughts on this, we try to bring consumer value in three different important ways. And one is drive the cost out of insurance products through eliminating commissions. Two, we work with fiduciary advisors who are going to provide appropriate financial advice. And then three, we use technology to help do product selection. And one of the things for me in it is having worked with fee-based advisors for the last almost 20 years, insurance had always been a conflict of interest, right? So it was lost revenue if somebody recommended an annuity. Consequently, you see RIAs who've been in business for 20 years and they never met a customer they thought could benefit from an annuity, right? And the point being, every business model has conflicts of interest. So we try to eliminate some of them, but I mean, you make that point and it's a fair one. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that thought.
Yeah, I agree completely that every business model has its conflicts of interest, and every business model should be required to mitigate those conflicts of interest to ensure that those conflicts of interest don't taint the advice. And as you mentioned, there are fee-based advisors who have never met an annuity that they think is appropriate, despite the fact that annuities can have their place in a retirement plan. So those conflicts should be mitigated as well. And then back to the point about commissions, my issue is not necessarily with commissions. If those commissions are relatively, you know, if they're reasonable and there's no incentive to recommend one annuity over another. But the problem with a lot of annuities that we see is there are some annuities that provide higher commissions to be sold. And so that creates an incentive for the financial professional to recommend the annuity that provides the highest commission, regardless of whether that is the best fit for the consumer. And even worse, there are non-cash compensation benefits that can be provided to financial professionals for selling certain types of annuities. And so they can get an all-expense-paid vacation to an exotic location,
right?
Gifts to entertainment, golf outings, meals, jewelry. And those are the types of incentives that encourage and reward financial professionals for recommending and selling certain products over others. And then those costs have to come from somewhere. Where do they come from? The consumer.
That's right. It's all built into the product pricing. You know, that's one of the common misconceptions, you know, I hear in arguments. So, I mean, generally, you know, when I'm defending fees against commissions, people will say, well, it's really a choice between whether you want to pay a one-time upfront fee or you want to pay an ongoing fee. And I said, no, not in the case of annuities, right? That is not the question for the consumer. That's the question for the advisor. How would you like to be compensated? One time up front with a commission or ongoing through some kind of an advice fee? For the consumer, they're paying the same way. They're paying ongoing through elevated product costs if they get a commissioned product, or they're paying ongoing financial advice, which is a separate service, optional to pay. It's not built into the product cost, which is where I, you know, come down on, make the case for a commission for me. I find that a hard time, making the case, but I'm try to be open-minded, but don't try to make the argument that one time up front might be better for the consumer than paying ongoing, because that's not the question for the consumer. They're paying ongoing, whether they never hear from that commissioned advisor again or not, they're continuing to pay for that commission for as long as they own the product.
Yeah, you make fair points. And the problem with a lot of these products is they're so complex, and retirement investors may not understand the features of these products. And also, these products can be, as you know, incredibly opaque. And so investors rely on financial professionals for their recommendations, and the financial professionals have incentives to recommend whatever is best for them. And so there are a lot of really questionable, if not harmful, features that annuity products can have that benefit the financial professional and don't benefit, and in many cases harm,
right,
the consumer. Whether, and we've talked about many of these, whether it's complex proprietary indices instead of a simple S&P 500
yep.
index that a fixed indexed annuity follows. These can provide questionable benefits. Some of them are pretty gimmicky. They're very difficult to evaluate, and they can create unrealistic expectations on the part of the consumer.
Well, so one of the things, we think is important in what we do is, through the technology, be able to compare product, in terms of the benefit it will provide, which is a pretty different thing. So tying it back to your point on different products paying differently, and maybe that influences kind of advice that consumers get. If you look at a product like a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, a fairly simple product to compare. What's the rating of the company? How much are they going to pay you? Incredibly unpopular products, even though they're completely simple, because you have to ask, is it because people don't like the notion of a SPIA, or is it because the commissioned advisor or broker doesn't like the commission paid? Because the commission paid in a SPIA is typically only 2 or 3% because they're so easy to compare, right? So the carrier knows they can't pay the same 8, 10, 14% commission in a SPIA because they would be uncompetitive on rates and it would be quite apparent. So the commission on those products is so low. Does that drive their unpopularity, or does the fact that people don't, they try to blame it on people don't want to turn over their money to the insurance carrier? Well, there are ways of structuring a SPIA that becomes less of a concern, but it's the point of, in an easily compared product, they can't afford to pay the same kind of commissions as the complex ones, where lots of bells and whistles, pricing and costs that you can hide it a lot more.
Yeah. And in your example, that is a prime example of a complex, opaque, very high commission product being sold a lot more than a simple, in my view, higher quality product, and consumers pay the difference. So in the more complex, opaque, high commission product, those products typically have more illiquidity, higher surrender charges, longer surrender periods, higher baked-in costs. They typically underperform alternatives, and they can have really detrimental, confusing, weird crediting criteria that can be difficult to evaluate. And I've even seen products where insurance companies can reserve the right to unilaterally change any of these terms at any time, leaving the investor with little or no recourse. And so these are real world examples of how investors can be harmed when incentives drive financial professionals to effectively steer investors to products that provide the financial professional the most compensation rather than the annuity that is the highest quality and provides the best fit for the retirement investor.
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised when I tell them that, you know, income annuities, those SPIAs, only make up 3-4% of annual sales of annuities. That's how unpopular they are relative to other types. But let me jump back to DOL rule for a minute and talk about, you know, we talked about how ERISA was set up in the 70s, you know, designed for fiduciary advice around retirement plans. So RIAs, a lot of the advisors we work with really won't be as much affected because they're kind of operating under those same principles and guidelines already as fiduciaries. But who do you think are the advisors that are going to be most impacted by this?
You're right. Advisors who charge based on assets under management are already providing advice on a regular basis. And so they are typically already fiduciaries. There are a couple of instances where they would be affected. One is rollovers. Historically, the DOL has taken a position that rollover recommendations are not fiduciary advice, regardless of how you charge and are otherwise regulated. And as I mentioned earlier, there have been significant increase in rollovers in the last couple of decades because financial professionals have an incentive to capture assets and charge on them. And so investment advisors who charge based on assets under management are going to have to take greater care when recommending rollovers and ensuring that those rollovers genuinely are in the best interest of the investor, not just in their own financial interest. So that, I think, is the biggest example of where investment advisors who charge based on assets under management are going to be impacted under the rule.
Yes. And then the typical, you know, annuity salesperson who might target rollovers as well, another, you know, popular practice, they're, you know, likely to be impacted as well in a different way.
Yeah, that's right. So broker dealers who recommend rollovers weren't affected before or weren't fiduciaries before, and they are likely to be fiduciaries now.
Yes. So just recommending your favorite annuity product for the rollover won't cut it effectively over in the new DOL rules. They're going to have to, again, just like you described for the RIA, show why it's in the client's best interest to make that move to that particular annuity and even relative to other annuity options that might be out there.
Yeah. They're going to have to be prudent. And they're going to have to be loyal, and they're going to have to charge reasonable amounts for their services and the products that they recommend. And I think that that is going to fundamentally change the dynamics in the market, because up till now, products compete based on how much compensation they provide. But now, under the new DOL rule, it's going to force products and services to compete based on cost and quality. And I think that that's going to lower costs and improve the quality and reduce the conflicts of interest in the market. And so financial professionals are going to have to do much more due diligence and provide higher quality, lower cost services, which are going to benefit consumers. Obviously, that money is going to come from somewhere. And that means that financial professionals probably won't be able to make as much money, charge as much money for their services that they provide. But currently, the market doesn't compete based on market dynamics. And under the new rule, it will. And I think that that's a benefit.
Yeah.
And people like you will step up and show how products can compete based on cost and quality and drive a lot of those changes. And I'm excited about the developments that are likely to happen that are going to benefit consumers.
Me too. I think it's hard for the insurance industry to kind of embrace it because it's scary, right? It's change. It's scary. It's different than what they're used to. But I'm an ardent and firm believer that this will embracing a fiduciary standard will ultimately be very, very good for the insurance industry. You know, one of the challenges of the industry right now is the lack of consumer trust in a lot of cases. Some consumers, you know, haven't been scared away, you know, from annuities, but many have, and many financial advisors have, you know, and I think embracing a fiduciary approach will vastly expand the market for insurance over time. And all of the things you described are so good for consumers. How can you argue against, well, we see how people argue against, but you know, how can you rationally argue against the fact that we should be doing things that are going to benefit the consumer through better advice, higher quality product, better pricing, et cetera? And you know, this is progress that is going to be helpful for both the industry and the consumer, even though it's a little scary, you know, for the industry to try to deal with the change. And you know, with that, I'll let you leave us with a few parting thoughts and wrap it up. And I really thank you for your time today. It's been great, Micah. But any parting thoughts relative to DOLs and consumer protections?
This rule is a huge win for consumers. It's going to improve the quality of retirement and advice. It's going to reduce conflicts of interest, and it's going to force products to compete based on their cost and quality, not how much they pay the financial professional. And the impact on the insurance industry is going to be particularly significantly helpful to consumers. It's going to improve their product features. It's going to reduce their costs, ultimately benefiting retirement savers. And just to provide you one estimate, Morningstar estimates that the rule will save investors who purchase fixed indexed annuities $32.5 billion in the first 10 years. And so those are tangible benefits that consumers are going to receive. And as you mentioned, most of the opposition to the rule has come from the insurance industry. They've been willing to go to war to preserve their ability to effectively characterize themselves as trusted advisors and then turn around and sell excessively high cost, low quality commissions. But I again want to say that financial professionals are not bad people. They're just operating in a system of bad incentives. And if we change those incentives, financial professionals are ultimately going to do what's best for consumers, and everyone is going to benefit. And I think that people like you are going to step up to the plate and show it's possible to improve the quality of products and services while still allowing the industry to thrive.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's, you know, we're, I think we bring a lot of value to consumers and advisors, but it's a different model. You know, we have to operate leanly. And that's, you know, the companies I've built in my career, that's the case. I mean, we operate on a, you know, leaner costs, leaner margins in order to provide better products for the consumer. And that's not an unreasonable thing to ask. I've just always believed if you can provide true benefit to the consumer, you'll build a good business. You just need to execute well and you know, always keep the, you know, truly keep the consumer in mind.
I agree completely.
Terrific. Well, this has been so good, Micah. I really appreciate your time today. We'll be seeing each other around the CFP board and probably in some of the same articles written on this topic.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed chatting with you today.
Thanks, Micah.
Thanks for listening. To hear more advisor revelations, go to dplfp.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming app.